Hello and welcome to a very special Betting People indeed. For today's guest is well known both in the circles of flat racing and also, of course, the circles of international sports. I have the honour and privilege of speaking to none other than Michael Holding, who has taken time out of his schedule to join us today. Michael, thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
I am pretty good, thanks. And thanks for inviting me. Everything has been good my end so far.
Lovely. Let's hope that continues. So first things first, want to get into the thick of how you got into racing, because those eager watchers of everything that you do will know that you're very much into your horse racing and that you started out at Kane Manor Park. Now, tell us a bit more about that place and how it all started.
Well, my interest in horses started when I was very, very young. My older brother, 6 years older than I am, he had a godmother that owned the horses, and she lived next door to us on Dunrobing Avenue in Kingston, Jamaica. And whenever she went down to the racetrack in the morning, not on a race day, on racetrack in the mornings to see our horses, my brother would go with her. And because he's my older brother, I wanted to tag along. So that's where the interest started. I would go with him initially before I even got the double figures. And it just grew and grew from that. When I went to high school, KC in Jamaica, I had friends who loved horse racing. They then dragged me into it further. And as I said, it just kept on growing. It got to the point where I owned horses in Jamaica, went down to Caymanas Park on a regular basis, went down to the stables. On the other occasion, very, very other occasion, I might go down in the morning to watch exercises. But that wasn't too regular.
Okay. And you went racing there plenty. Do tell me, actually, the crowds there, were they sort of mainly local, or were there plenty of tourists there, or was it a mixture of the two? And, you know, was it a sport that was seen as elite, or did everybody really participate?
No, it wasn't an elite sport in Jamaica initially when I started to get involved. You might have people who own horses that people might think are the elite of the society. But everyone got involved. And in the early 60s, in the 60s and early 70s, we had some top-class jockeys who came to Jamaica to ride. A lot of English jockeys came out there. People like Lester Piggott, George Duffield, Raymond Still, Dennis Mackay, all those guys, Joe Mercer, all those guys came out to Jamaica in the winter, of course, in England to ride out there because, you know, the standard of racing in Jamaica was pretty high. They would get their holidays in a nice, warm climate. Because remember those days, you didn't have anything called all-weather racing. So it was just jumps during the winter. So they got a great holiday. And they came out and they enjoyed themselves riding around Caymanas Park.
Wonderful. Can you actually remember, did you bet much, actually, when you were at the track? And if so, can you remember your first bet or your first win?
No, I wouldn't remember the first of anything like that, to be honest, because I was betting from I was going to high school when I shouldn't have been. And my mother, if she ever found out, and sometimes she did find out that I had a bet, she would scream the house down because she was totally against it. But I wouldn't remember my first bet or the first time I ever won or anything like that, because, you know, as a kid at that age, you're not really concentrating that much on saying, yes, this is my first bet or the first time I ever won. But I've been betting since those days, and, you know, as I started to own more and more horses and get more and more deeply involved, I continued betting. I enjoy it. Not that I bet to try and win a fortune, but I just enjoy the task of trying to beat the bookyard to try to find a winner. I enjoy that aspect of it.
I'm very sure everybody listening to this will agree wholeheartedly with that. Now, at Caymanas Park, one thing actually I was really interested to know was all the betting there done on track? Did you have to go there, much like it was, say, in the States? Or did you have some bookies like you could have had in Britain, for example? When I was watching your one of the Sky Sports movies about you, I never quite got that out, so I'm interested to know.
We had betting shops in Jamaica. Different companies had betting shops in Jamaica, and the shops were sprinkled all over the island. And you could go into the betting shops and have a bet. But of course, the odds that you got were the odds coming from Caymanas Park. They were the tote odds.
Yeah.
You have too many bookmakers in Jamaica that would offer their own odds. One bookmaker tried it, I can't remember, many, many years ago, and got slaughtered because he put up this horse at a particular odds, and I don't know if they got the wrong information on this horse, because you know bookmakers get information. And this, they were slaughtered. People just backed this horse as if it had already won. And I don't think that lasted very long. So they are still called bookmakers, but they don't make their own books. They use the totals.
I'm sure that's something that many people watching will be familiar with, and perhaps bring some fond memories there too. Another thing, actually, I would like to ask you about your time racing in Jamaica, but horse ownership, you know, was it always something that you wanted to do? Was it sort of a natural next step, or were you encouraged by friends to get into the game?
Well, I got involved with a very good friend of mine in Jamaica that I had known for many, many years. He had been owning horses for many, many years. He went to high school, and not the same school, of course, as my sisters. He went to all-boys school, my sisters went to an all-girls school, and then they met up again at university. And so I knew him from when I was a kid. And he got involved in horses, and he has owned horses. He has been champion owner in Jamaica many occasions. A matter of fact, if you watch that move, that thing that Sky did, when I went to Kimmel's Park, that is the gentleman. He's one of his horses, one that day, Howard Hamilton. And I got involved with him to a small degree in that we were partners in a couple of horses. He had his, I never had any of on my own, but we then got in partnership together to have a few horses. And then eventually I had a few on my own. And that is how I got into the ownership aspect of it. Because when I got into partnership with Howard, he was very kind to me. I didn't pay a lot of the fees. He paid most of the fees, and it was just a matter of associating me with the horses. And then eventually when I got horses on my own, then I had to pay everything up naturally. But that's how I got in. I love the sport. I want to be more involved than just a spectator. And I enjoy being involved as an owner as well.
Absolutely. And just quickly, because we're coming to the end of part one and your initial discoveries into racing, what's your favorite racing memory from Caymanas Park?
Well, my favorite racing memories would be whenever my horses won. And that has to be my favorite. You know, there were some great horses involved at Caymanas Park long before I got to the point where I could even think of owning horses. I remember two sprinters at Caymanas Park that had some serious battles. One was called Touchwood and one was called Nonsuch. And I remember those battles between those two horses. And they were trained by the two best trainers in Jamaica at the time, Lawrence Silveira and A.E. Billy Williams. And those battles, you know, monumental. You don't forget about those battles. But me personally, when your horse wins, there's no greater high than that.
Sure, plenty of people watching will again agree with that. Thank you very much for talking about your early memories at Caymanas Park, Michael Holding. Stay tuned for part two of Betting People after this. Welcome back to Betting People with Michael Holding. Now, in this part, we're going to talk a bit more about Michael's experiences in Newmarket, where he's lived for many years. And of course, you are, Michael, a close friend of the great Sir Michael Stout. Tell us how you ended up meeting him.
Well, that stems from the fact that I had horses in Jamaica. And the trainer that trained my horses in Jamaica, one of his daughters got married to a Bajan, as we call people from Barbados Bajan, for those who might not be aware of the term. And she got married to this guy, and he knew Michael Stout. Now, in 1985, he came up to spend some time in Newmarket. I was at Derbyshire playing county cricket. That was my first full year of playing county cricket at Derbyshire. And he called me and said to me, "Would you like to come and meet Michael Stout?" Because he knew of my association with races in Jamaica with his wife's father and that sort of a thing. And I said, "Absolutely, tell me where and when." And of course, they gave me directions to come down this Newmarket and exactly where to go. And so I drove down when I had a couple of days free from Derbyshire, went down to the stables, And Michael Stowe was at Evening Stables one afternoon. Don't remember exactly which afternoon it was. I just remember it was 1985. And from that day, the friendship with him just grew and grew. And of course, with me being able to work for Sky and for the last 22 years going to England every summer, that just gave me more and more opportunities to go to Newmarket, to go to the stables, and to build that friendship with him.
Wonderful. And just for those who haven't been there, because we have plenty of trainers on betting people, what's it like at Freemason Lodge? You know, what sets him and the facilities apart from, you know, plenty of other people who have horses? Because he's been so successful over the years.
It's difficult for me to say what he has or what he does that sets him apart from others, because I'm not really someone who would visit a lot of stables to say, okay, Michael Stowe stables has this, these stables don't have that. I'm not au fait with other trainers as to exactly how they operate. I know a lot of trainers in Newmarket, but I'm not in their yard every day with their horses every day to know exactly how they operate for me to then say, okay, Michael Stowe does this differently from them. But what I know about Michael Stowe and all the years that I have spent with him, and I'm not saying this to say other trainers are not the same, because as I say, I don't know. But from my association with him, what I can say is that he's a very patient person. He also tries to know each horse as an individual. He knows they're all different animals. They all have different characteristics. They all have different personalities, although people will tell you, oh, a horse has a personality. No way. But I know they do. And he understands that, and he tries to differentiate them in that way and treat them differently, instead of just having a treadmill where you're just turning out horses day in, day out. So that I know about him. I also know that he has a photographic memory. In my early days at Michael Stowe, I never saw him with a piece of paper. He would go into the yard and he would remember exactly what each horse had did. And that's the days when he had a lot more horses than he has now. Now, I don't know exactly how many, but he perhaps have 130 horses. Those days, he perhaps had 190, 200 horses. And he would know each individual one. He would know what they had done over a period of time. And he knew exactly what to tell each jockey as they passed him what to do. Because he had his plans exactly when they would be running, exactly how far from today he wanted them to do what. Obviously now he has gotten a little bit older. He needs to have his paper to remember his notes and that sort of thing. But I never saw Michael Stowe with a piece of paper in the early days. And he had this characteristic of writing things in his palm, pretend to write, because obviously he's not writing anything. And when he wrote it in his palm, because of the photographic memory, he would even rub it out. But that was just one of his things that he did. And once he did that, he never forgot it. And, you know, people say he's a genius. There are lots of geniuses, but I know that he is fantastic when it comes to his horses.
Very well said. I think plenty of fans of Michael Stowe would agree with that. You live in Newmarket now, and you have done for some time. Did your relationship with Sir Michael play a big part in you moving there and basing yourself there?
When you say I live in Newmarket, I think the word that you just used, basing myself there, is more appropriate. I base myself there for the summer, because when I'm working with Sky, that's where I am. And absolutely, that's the reason why I am in Newmarket. For the very first year when I went to work for Sky, 1995, I hadn't gotten a full-term contract yet. But they were putting me up for that summer because West Indies were touring and I was working with Sky. And I was asked by my boss at the time, John Gaylord, where I wanted to live. And I said Newmarket, because you know they were going to pay the rent for wherever I was. And they were quite happy, because obviously the rent in London is a lot more than the rent in Newmarket. They were happy that I was happy to go to Newmarket. And since 1995, I've been going back to England and staying in Newmarket. I was renting a place right opposite to Michael Stowe's yard for a few years. Then eventually, when my family wanted to come and join me during the summer months in Newmarket, I had to then buy somewhere, because I was just renting a one-bedroom flat at the time. So I had to then buy a house in Newmarket. And that's where I have been now for donkey's years. And obviously that gives me the opportunity to go to the stables every morning. Once I'm not working with Sky, I'm at the stables every morning because it's 5 minutes away from where I'm actually living. So it's easy access, and that has made things very, very nice for me.
Wonderful indeed. Quite a few people who will be watching this may have had an interest in horses, in owning horses in the past, and who may actually own horses now. Obviously, it's a tricky time for the racing industry, but I wanted to talk basically a bit more about racehorse ownership and that experience, because this is a tough time for the industry, and plenty of people who watch Betty People who would have been guests will either have had an interest in owning racehorses in the past or might currently do. What would you say to people who might be thinking about getting into racehorse ownership? Because it's a time when the industry needs it and it can bring great benefits. And I wanted to know what some of those were for you.
Well, what I'd say to those people is that, you know, this is not ideal right now. As things stand right now, to be owning horses and being unable to really enjoy the total experience of going to the races and going in the ring and celebrating if your horse is winning and that sort of thing. But what I'd say to them is they know the enjoyment that would have brought them in the past. And you have to just be a little bit patient. Mm. One would hope that things will improve and improve dramatically next year. You know, and people will be able to almost go back, not to normal, but to as close as normal as you possibly can and get back to enjoying that sport. Because I don't think I need to tell people who have owned horses that when that horse wins, it gives you such a high. As I've said on some interviews in the past, when my horse won a race, I felt better than when I took 5 weeks in a test match. Those 5 weeks in a test match were fantastic. And they would have helped my team to win the match or to put up a good performance. But then you have to move on because your job lies ahead. You have more work to do. When your horse wins, it's celebration time. You can't think, oh, I have other things to do. You can fully consume yourself into that moment when the horse wins and when you can celebrate that feeling that you got. And as we all know, so many horses run on tracks. And so many have never win a race. So many owners struggle to win as many races as they would like. So when you have that winner, it's a moment that you need to be able to celebrate and really celebrate to the fullest. So I can understand right now that people can be a little bit disappointed with the way things are going, but it's a matter of patience. Just as if you have a nice two-year-old and the trainer says to you, listen, we're going to be patient with this two-year-old. He could be a nice horse as a three-year-old. The same thing happening now. You just have to be patient and hope that things get better.
You're known as, or at least if the Sky cricket team are to be believed, you're known as somebody who's a little bit of a form student in their spare time. I'd like you to tell the viewers what you think or what you really take into account when you're trying to make selections.
Well, you have to take everything into account. There are no shortcuts. You have to know the history of the horse. That's why I'm not too big on betting on two-year-olds, because there's no form to study. I can't know what I need to be backing unless I get information. And I don't like just relying on information. So you have to take everything into consideration. The previous performances of the horse, under what conditions those horses or that horse performed, like distance and the type of ground and the trainer, the jockey, the type of form that the trainer is in, all those things have to be taken into consideration. So that's why it is such a long effort, such a hard job to really go into all the details to try and find which horse you should be backing. But at the same time, you can do all that hard work and that horse, perhaps that day just didn't feel right. It doesn't perform to the expectations. If it was as simple as that, you wouldn't really have bookmakers. Everybody would be a winner, because following the form is hard work, but it's not impossible. But at the same time, because horses are animals and animals have good days and bad days, it makes it more difficult.
Very precise answer then. I'm sure plenty of people will appreciate that. You've been racing plenty of times in Britain, I presume. A lot of people have been talking recently, albeit in extraordinary circumstances, about the race day experience for owners. Owners are some of the people who are lucky enough to get on the course at the moment. If and when things return to normal, is there anything that you'd like to see improved about the race day experience?
Well, what is happening now, owners can go to the races, yes, but they still can't get the full experience of ownership. They can't go into the ring, for instance, and have to work with the jockey or the trainer, or actually being close up with their horses. So it's a slightly different experience to what they're accustomed to doing. Owning horses, I think a lot of people understand what it means. A lot of horses don't pay for themselves. So a lot of owners would go into the sport not as a business, some do, yes, but not necessarily as a business, but as something recreational, and they know it has a cost of that recreational aspect of their life. And that is what owning horses is all about. Next year, you'll have more fun. And that is why I think a lot of people are so unhappy this year and what has been happening this year, because it's costing. Horses don't return on the investment. And at the same time, they're not getting the fun that they are hoping that they would have had. So that just makes things a little bit more difficult. But hopefully next year, everyone will be able to go back. They'll be able to go into the ring, because that is a great experience. Walking into that ring, and you know that you have an affiliation with a particular horse. Going into the ring, being able to even just have a quiet word with the jockey, not necessarily anything to do with the race, but just say hello and what to be able to talk to the jockey, to talk to the trainer, and then walk back up to watch your horse perform in that race. All of that is a part of the experience. And I know owners are right now are a little bit worried about that aspect of things. Spending all this money and not getting the fun and the real enjoyment that they are looking for.
I think that is very well said, and hopefully things do change with that. Just quickly to end this part, plenty of people in cricket do have an interest in the sport of racing. Of course, you are well amongst them. How popular is racing within cricket, and is it still something that's growing actually amongst current and ex-pro players?
I think it's fairly popular. Even before I started to play for the West Indies, we had quite a few West Indian cricketers who I know were very interested in horse racing. And in my team, there were a few, not many. I would say no more than 10%, actually. Not a lot in the team that I played in the 80s. When I played county cricket in England, there were again a few in the county team, but not at the level that you would like, because you would like to see. Well, I would at any rate, because I love horses and I love to see the participation growing. And I'd love to see more people of my background and my race and my sort of skills getting involved with racing. I would love to see a lot more diversity. And I don't see a lot of that when I go to the racetrack. I know what before racing was on television on a regular basis, because I've been going to England since 1976. I would go into betting shops. I would see a lot of West Indians, a lot of BAME, as they say now, in the betting shop, but not on the racetrack. And I think a lot of them do not think that the racetrack is the right atmosphere for them, because when they look on the screens and when they look at people at the racetrack, they don't see many that look like them. So that is the aspect of it that I would like to see improve. A lot more diversity in all spheres of horse racing, not just in the betting shops, in all angles and different ways of horse racing.
A very strong note upon which to end part two of Betting People. Thank you very much, Michael Holding.
My pleasure.
Hello, and welcome back to part three of Betting People with Michael Holding. Now, we've talked an awful lot about Michael's experiences within racing, but of course, he is known primarily for being a brilliant cricketer and, of course, a brilliant commentator for Sky. So we're going to talk about his cricketing career in this part. And firstly, actually, because it's not a question I've heard you ask much, but how did you actually get into cricket? Obviously, being a Jamaican and being in the Caribbean, it's a very integral part of the culture there. But can you remember sort of the first time you played or your first experiences? How did you end up getting, you know, into your local team?
Well, I played all the sports that were available to me as a kid. When I was at school or when I was just with my friends, we would play different sports at different times of the year, because those days, sports actually had seasons. You played cricket during the summer, you'd play football in the so-called winter, obviously no winter in the Caribbean. And different times you did different things. And I just played them because they were available there to be played. As time went on, I was exposed more to cricket than anything else because I was a member of a cricket club from I was a kid, from I was born, my father registered me at the club. And that club, although it was a football and a cricket club, eventually started doing and playing only cricket. The football sort of just sticked by the wayside. And with the exposure at the club and playing more and more cricket, that aspect developed a lot more than anything else. Not that I could have done anything else to the levels at which I do or did play cricket, but because I was exposed more to cricket than anything else. And I played my first official cricket match where you had an umpire and you wore your whites and that sort of a thing at about age 10. It was for the community in which I lived. We used to have what was called the Ranking Cup in Jamaica as a kid, that communities and workplaces played in that competition. And my community had a team, and that was where I played my first ever match as a 10-year-old. You know, the guys in the area went up to my mother and asked her if I could go and play, if I could play in this game. And of course, at age 10, you have no cricket gear as such. And my sister had to rush off to the shopping center to try and get me a pair of white pants, and I played in this white pants and a white T-shirt in that very first game. So it was just a matter of growing up as a kid and playing up the sports available and, you know, being selected to play in this game because the guys thought I could play a little bit of cricket.
Indeed, and as they say, the rest is history. You, speaking of history, you were part of the great West Indies team that won Test Series pretty much here, there and everywhere. But your first tour in England was sort of particularly famous, and particularly some would say notorious in some areas. When Tony Greig, who was the captain at that time, made the famous grovel comments, just give us an insight into the reaction amongst you and also the rest of your teammates then, because many people say, and I don't disagree with them, that it added an extra edge to the series, that it added an extra element of fire to your and your teammates' play.
Yes, it did. Yeah, not everyone heard that comment live. I actually did, because 1976, and in those early days when teams toured England, the touring team did not play cricket on a Sunday. And the only cricket played in England on a Sunday those days was, I think it was called a joint player league, a 40 or I think it might have been a 40-over tournament. And it started in the afternoon because, you know, those days the thought was you were in the church in the morning, you know, and then you'd get a short game of cricket after lunch on Sundays. And we, in the hotels, didn't have television sets in our rooms. Again, going back to the 70s, people won't even remember these things, but you didn't have television sets in your rooms. So if you wanted to watch the telly, you had to go down into the lobby where there was a television set. But at the same time, more times than not, whatever you wanted to watch would have been on the screen, because you only had three channels in those days, BBC One, BBC Two, and ITV. So there was cricket on one of the BBC stations, and of course the cameras went down to Sussex where they were filming that game, and did an interview with Tony Greig, the England captain. And I remember him saying it clearly about, you know, the West Indies being very good, but when they're on top, they are brilliant, and when they're down, they tend to grovel. And he and Brian Close and a few others intend to make us grovel. Now, the few of us who heard it live made sure that everybody else in the team knew about it. And then, of course, in the team meeting, we discussed what he was saying. And, of course, with him being South African, because he was a South African playing for England, and with the apartheid regime in power in South Africa, we didn't take kindly to the word grovel in particular. And we decided, okay, that's what he thinks of us. We're going to let them know exactly what groveling is all about. And we pretty much most of the team thought it was a racist comment to be saying what he said and the way he said it. Many years afterwards, I didn't know Tony Gregg. Many years afterwards, I got to know Tony Gregg very well. Spent a lot of time with him working on television and in other avenues. And I got to realize that Tony Gregg was not what we thought of as someone that was racist, making a racist comment. I did not find him racist in the least. And he just made a comment at the wrong time and used the wrong words. But that spurred us on a great deal. And every time he came to bat, the fast bowlers would find a bit more energy, irrespective of what time of the day it was, and would bowl a little bit quicker. And the batsmen that batted with him didn't enjoy it either.
No, not at all. Indeed, plenty of batsmen from that era, including, I think it was Dennis Army, have recalled that. Another very famous moment from your career, the tour of New Zealand, one where, I think to say the least, the umpires may have stolen the show. And of course, you remember the famous kicking the stumps incident. Yeah. Just two questions, I guess, to ask that. Number one, with the benefit of hindsight, do you think at that point in your career or in the heat of the moment, you could have seen yourself doing that same thing again? And secondly, do you actually regret it?
Well, number one, you can't say that if you went back to that moment that you wouldn't do it again. It's just a spur of the moment reaction. As you said, in the heat of the battle, you react and you do something that should not have taken place on a cricket field. You can't condone that sort of behavior on a cricket field. But I couldn't say to you now, 40 odd years later, that if I went back 40 years in the past and it happened, I wouldn't do it again, because it's not something that you plan to do. You would hope that you would learn from experiences, and I learned from that experience that it never happened again. That wasn't the only time that I thought umpires were being a little bit partial. But you hope you learn from experiences and you don't repeat your mistakes. So that experience was a horrid experience for me and for the team that I played in. And I don't think anyone can say that they saw anything like that from either myself or any members of my team after that one experience. Also, whether you ask if I would regret it, again, that is not something that I can answer and say, yes, I regret it, because I think an incident like that and other incidents that took place on a cricket field has influenced the ICC to now have the independent panel of umpires, which I think is the best thing that has ever happened to the game of cricket, an independent panel of umpires where you go to a country and you can think to yourself, and again, think, because perception sometimes is greater than reality. You can think to yourself that you're getting a fair shake. The DRS has helped in that regard as well. But before the independent panel of umpires, a home umpire making a genuine mistake, you'd automatically think this man is cheating. Automatically, whether it was genuine mistake or he was deliberately being biased, you automatically, as a visiting team, you think he's cheating. With the independent panel of umpires, that has gone through the window. You get rid of that immediately. So I think the incident with myself, with Mike Gatting in Pakistan, with Sunil Gavaskar, and with Muralidharan in Australia, all those things combined helped to put pressure on the body responsible for the game to have this independent panel of umpires. And I think, as I said, that's the best thing that has ever happened.
Fascinating insights, and I'm sure we all thank you for them. Just out of interest, moving forward a bit from your playing career, you've seen, many different eras of cricket. And one of the things I'm particularly interested in getting from you is, who do you think is the best batsman you've enjoyed watching since you started broadcasting with Sky?
I wouldn't be able to pick one. I've seen so many great batsmen since I started with my broadcast on Sky. I start off with overseas batsmen, first of all, before I get to my home batsmen. When Sachin Tendulkar was playing, I used to enjoy watching Sachin Tendulkar bat. I think he was a master batsman. More recently, from the same country, Rahul Dravida after that, and then more recently now Virat Kohli. I enjoy watching those people bat. In my broadcast days, I have been able to see Kane Williamson, who is, in my opinion, is a fantastic player. You know, I've seen South African, AB de Villiers, you know, again, highly skillful. From England recently, Joe Root, you know, there are so many batsmen, different parts of the world that I've enjoyed watching. So I wouldn't be able to pick one. You know, these guys, you can admire their skill, you can admire their craftsmanship. To then differentiate them to pick one would be quite difficult. If I now think about home cricketers, Brian Lara, you know, his skill is just out of this world. I have never seen a better batsman against Spin Bowling, never. And I'm not just talking about broadcast days, I'm talking about in my playing days. I just haven't seen a better batsman against Spin Bowling.
And I mean, a brilliant selection there of wonderful batsmen. You're a fast bowler, tremendous one, bowled with a lot of pace. We've been blessed, I think, for all the eras of cricketing history to have tremendous pace bowlers. I'm sure you'll give me more than one answer, but who is the, let's say that you were getting your pads on, who is the fast bowler you would have least like to face? And let's actually say from all of your time in cricket.
No, I could give you 100 of them. I couldn't bat. So I could give you 100 of them, but I wouldn't want to bat again. But just watching fast bowlers, over the last, say, 20 years, Dale Steyn. I think he is the best fast bowler I've seen in the modern era. You know, if you start going back, it's difficult to compare eras, but if you start going back many years, you're going to start talking about people like Dennis Lilly and Andy Roberts from the Caribbean, Malcolm Marshall, Richard Hadley. I wouldn't want to compare them, but just in their eras, they were great fast bowlers. But Dale Steyn in the modern era, it's difficult for me to find someone that I would say has been better than him.
I think it's an answer plenty of people would agree with. Personally, Dale Steyn also a massive favourite of mine from that wonderful era of the South African bowling attack with him, Philander, and of course, Wally Morkel. We're coming to the end of this, and it's been a brilliant interview, and I want to thank you for having taken the time out. But the state of... we talked a lot about cricket, and you've talked a lot about not only cricket in the past, but cricket potentially in the future. We've been lucky enough, and we are lucky enough as we speak, to have cricket played now. Do you think the game will basically adapt and survive to the continuing pressures on it? You've had, even I think before COVID, plenty of structural changes. Can you see... international cricketing boards and teams making it through this period, looking forward into the future, maybe 5 years down the line?
Yeah, I think 5 years is a short period of time. I don't think you'll see a lot of changes in 5 years. 5 years is a short period of time, but I would suggest that whatever changes that are needed for the game to survive will be made. You know, at the moment, they're facing COVID, which is very, very difficult. You have to be playing in the bubbles. No, still here in South Africa saying that their current tour is coming up when England go down there, even at Christmas, they'll be having to play in a bubble. So you have to just adjust at the moment. You know, people will be happy for the time being to be able to watch it on their television sets. People are missing the atmosphere of being at the ground. But like any other thing, we have to have some patience. We have to make whatever adjustments are necessary. And then hopefully we can go back to close to being normal in the not too distant future. Not enough is known about COVID. Not enough is known about this virus that's going around now for people to predict anything. We have the greatest scientists in the world working on this thing, and the story keeps on changing. So I wouldn't think anyone will be able to predict anything about the future, the immediate future at any rate. But we just have to be doing the most sensible things, do what seems to work, and hope that things get better. And I'm sure cricket will be able to make the necessary adjustments to survive through this and will blossom afterwards.
A wonderful note upon which to end this very special Betting People. Thank you so much for your time, Michael Holding.
My pleasure.
Follow our top sporting brand ambassadors, Davy Russell, Sylvester D'Souza, and Ryan Sidebottom for their exclusive news, views, and tips on all the major events with blogs and vlogs at starsportsbet.co.uk, begambleaware.org. Over 18 only.